Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Got a lot going on the show today. Later on, we're going to be speaking about complexity science, and we're also going to be speaking to Todd Lester, who is at the Santa Fe Art Institute. He's from a group called Free Dimensional, and they are talking about migration and refugees from all over the world. Right now, I would like to welcome Shelley Mann Lev, who is with the Santa Fe Public Schools Office of Student Wellness, and her daughter, Eliana Ward-Lev, who is a sixth grader at the Santa Fe Girls School, and they are here every year to talk to us about Television Turnoff Week. Welcome, ladies.
Well, thank you so much, Mary Charlotte, for having you. It's a pleasure to be here now for our seventh year.
Wow. So yes. You've had 7 years of encouraging people to turn off their TVs.
You know, we've had 7 years of encouraging people to turn off their TVs, videos, DVDs, video games, and to think about the impact that all these screens are having on their life. You know, TV Turnoff Week starts today, and it runs for a week from today through April 27th, next Sunday. But the hope in it isn't just that, you know, during this week you'll turn off your screens, but you'll really think about how's it affecting you, how's it affecting your children, how's it affecting your parents, and hopefully discover that life is worth living, and real life is real fun, and that you can set some guidelines for yourself, because TV and videos and computer games are one of those things that kind of pull you in, and if you're not careful, I don't know, I know we've talked about it, they can end up kind of ruling your life instead of you deciding what's right for you and how much you want to watch.
Now, some of the subtleties about how it does affect your life are things that aren't necessarily apparent right away on the surface, or they're not necessarily attributed to TV. For example, there's a connection to obesity or toward overweightness in kids who have TVs in their bedroom.
There's a connection between obesity, between kids who watch screens, period. The more time you spend watching screens, the more obese you are in terms of statistically. And TVs in the bedrooms are connected to obesity, sleep problems, of course, increased violence, when you think about it. And unfortunately, every year the figures go up and up. I mean, the number of toddlers who have TVs in their bedrooms. You know, parents, we know that, you know, when you're 3 years old or when you're even 7 or 8, you know, that it's hard to make, sometimes hard to make good decisions for yourself, and it takes some parental help.
And well, and I think
a
lot of,
hard.
Yeah, and a lot of parents who are stressed out, who have maybe a bunch of kids, use the TV as a babysitter.
Well, they do, and so that's true.
Or even
and
one
at least
kid.
If it's in the living room, then you can see what your child's watching and can see that hours and hours are going by. When it's in their bedroom, which you raised, right? It's like a little hard, much harder to supervise and control. So kids actually will go to sleep with the TV on, wake up in the morning, turn it on, and you know, if you don't see it, you don't know what's going on. So you know, many people find that they think that they need the TV to help them when they need a break, and again, it's about choices, right? So if the TV's in a more public space, you can make more choices.
Now, 40% of Americans watch TV while eating dinner.
Yes.
That's a lot.
Well, it's interesting, you know. What do you think? I'm sitting with my daughter, who's now 12, has been coming here since she was 6, and we do have a TV, video, DVD-free household. What do we do during dinner?
We talk. We have conversations.
Yeah. You know, the art of family conversation. You know, it's when you kind of check in, see if someone's moping, see if someone's had a good day, something, you know, just share about the political campaign, whatever, the weather. The first thing people buy, they did a study of people who, you know, a lot of people don't have a lot of resources, money. People move into a new place. Before they buy a kitchen table, what do they buy? A TV. I was just talking with I work with the public schools, and we have a wonderful program for homeless children and families. And so I was talking with one of the people who works with that program, and I asked her how many of the people who don't have, you know, who either double up, you know, live in substandard housing conditions, have TVs. And she said basically everyone. It's almost before anything else. So that time together, they found around drug prevention, if you don't want your kids to smoke, drink, you know, get stoned, get high, that having dinner together at least half the time is singly the most significant indicator that your kids will live substance-free lives.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is interesting. Like, what is it, you know?
So it's all about, really, it's all about human one-on-one connection or conversation in groups connection.
It's all about relationship.
And the relationship with the TV isn't a real relationship because it doesn't respond to you.
Yeah, I mean, computers, we say, well, they're interactive. But maybe your complexity personalizer, but you're interacting with machine. It's not responding to you. It's not a personal relationship. And certainly, that's where the juice, you know, most of the juice of life comes either with relationship with people, like what we're doing right now, relationship with nature. I think that's real relationship, you know, with gardening or trees or the mountains or even that little, you know, arroyo that we have across the street from our house, you know, that our kids can run in. That's real relationship. And that seems to feed our souls. And when we're not fed in those ways, I think people turn to all kinds of things, whether it's obesity, you know, they're sitting and they stuff their, you know, I mean, I like to eat junk too, you know. But anyway, they...
Popcorn is a good invention, but...
Well, not when you
moderation.
Put butter on it.
Well, we could talk about that another time.
Well, that's true. I like it too. But you know what I mean. Maybe not in those supersized, huge containers.
There is something called nature deficit disorder. Well, I mean, yes. I think it is sort of funny that everything can be made into a... what would you call it? Psychologically definable disorder. But nevertheless, what is nature deficit disorder?
Well, we could answer that with another cute phrase, which is the guiding post of the new movement to connect children and all of ourselves back with nature is no child left inside.
Now, wasn't there a movement to, what was it, with the legislature? I have it written down here somewhere.
Yes.
There was a bill.
There was, and you know, I don't know that it was called the TV tax, and it was put forward by the Rio Grande chapter of the Sierra Club, hoping to do a very, very small tax on TV and video games. I think it was a 1% sales tax on those luxury items, because they are luxury items, with the hope of putting those resources towards outdoor education, and that, what I know you're referring to is there was a recent study done by some folks back east, a woman named Patricia Zeredick, and they found that people are spending 25% less time outside than they have in the past. And I think if we think about our own lives, particularly for the lives of our children are spending much, much, much less time outside. The draw indoors, video games, and they actually, again, have another term for it, another one of those psychological terms, videophilia, right?
Oh, my goodness.
That attraction to... But really, a lot of what I'm concerned about with kids, I am concerned about what kids are watching and what adults are watching, you know, the violence and all that, but it's just the time. Like, where do you... You know, what isn't happening, particularly for young children, but for all of us, when we're just, you know, frozen, we're not connecting to the natural world. And that can have many positive effects if you just hang out outside for a while.
I've quoted this probably more often than I should on this program, but I had an interview with the wonderful writer, Santa Fe writer, Miriam Sagan, who wrote a book called Gossip, but there's an essay in it in which which is called Time is on My Side, and she describes the reasons why she has all the time she needs. And one of the top three reasons is that she doesn't watch TV. And she talks about the difference between a half an hour spent watching TV and a half an hour spent hanging up your laundry in the yard. And one is a meditative activity that slows you down, and the other one is one that kind of revs you up, and the time goes by really quickly. When you hang up your laundry, it goes really slowly. And somehow, using time in a slow way gives you more time.
Yes. Wow, what an interest. I have to read that essay. You know, I was asking Eliana, my daughter, if there was something that she wanted to make sure kind of came across, you know, and what were you saying to me in the car on the way over here?
That it's not actually that hard. There's lots of other fun things to do. That you can read, talk to your friends, go play outside.
Right, you know, even like reading a book, there is that sense of opening up into this world, right? Like when you read, whereas if you spend it affects you differently. Again, I think one of the things that people sometimes think is, oh, I'm against all, whatever. And I really hope people will make conscious choices, choose those programs that really do feed them, that they're really, truly interested in. And what we were also talking about some of those Calvin and Hobbes cartoons. What was the one you told me?
The one about...
He was sitting and watching, and
Hobbes comes up and says, "Do you actually like this program?" He says, "No, but there's nothing better on."
Right.
You know, I want to watch, but...
Well, there's also a lot to be said for, and I did this yesterday because I was very tired and didn't have a lot of energy to go out, even, you know, to take a long walk or anything. Just, you sit in your yard and you look at the sky.
This is the part about No Child Left Inside. I mean, there is, you know, that TV tax, whatever, that whole sense, fewer and fewer people are visiting our national parks, that we live in the most beautiful, I don't know, I think Santa Fe is one of the most beautiful places on earth. And, you know, I was watching the sunset on Saturday night, you know, and thinking, this is free. You know, we're in these tough economic times, and taking a hike, watching the sunset, you know, putting a little water in our little tulips, just sitting outside, talking to somebody or not, just, you know, reflecting. Those are all things that don't cost more money, that don't encourage you to buy more things, gadgets that you don't need that you didn't even know you needed until you saw them. So,
right, there's another Calvin and Hobbes cartoon, which Calvin, after watching TV, goes up to his mom and says, "I just saw this gadget on TV and I didn't know it existed, but I desperately need it."
That's
doesn't
message.
Matter what it does. We're talking to Shelley Manlev and Ileana Wardlev about TV Turnoff Week. Now, there are always activities in Santa Fe associated with TV Turnoff Week.
Yeah, one of the things that the Santa Fe TV Turnoff Coalition is committed to doing is giving people alternatives, really turning them on to the many, many opportunities in Santa Fe. So,
by the way, radios are not included in the list of things to be turned off.
They are not.
They are not.
It's a different experience.
Yeah.
And maybe, unfortunately, for radios, we don't get addicted to them in the same kind of way. But they do have a different impact than those all those visual screen images. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I love KSFR.
Well, it's completely self-serving on my part.
I understand. You know, it's good. Good self-serving. So all kids in Santa Fe public schools, elementary schools, and many, many of the private schools got these lists, or will get them today. Hopefully they got them last week. They got free passes to the Children's Museum and Genevieve Chavez and Fort Marcy, which we're really excited about. And then today, there's one activity, but there's about, 12 activities throughout the week. You can see the list in the Santa Fe New Mexican, one of the sponsors of KSFR, I know. And also you can call 467-2573. But tonight, for example, there's a magic show with Paul Glickman at 7 o'clock at Lafarge Library. We have drumming tomorrow night, a healthy food festival at the co-op, just lots of fun things. Free bowling on Saturday night, free roller skating on Friday night.
Bowling? There's bowling.
Bowling. It's really
fun. Down in Rufina Circle.
Rufina Circle. Free bowling Saturday night from 7:30 to 11:30. It's one of my favorite things to do, actually.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's always fun.
Now, you talk to families who have, for the first time, turned off their television for a week. What kind of reports do you get back?
You know, one of the things I love about TV Turnoff Week is all the conversations I have with people as they're at these events. And I hope I get to meet some of your listeners there. People report, are often very, very surprised. They're surprised that their kids do find things to do. They're surprised. Many times it's their children who come at home from school and say, "I really want to do this." And often it's hardest for the parents. So, you know, their kids are the ones, and I know children who say, I just do it. I just leave the room while my, you know, because it's something I want to try. So the sense they often find is, A, their kids are kind of hungry to talk to them. B, they find that boredom turns into something, you know, a little creative, maybe a little messy. One family was telling me they had fewer fights because they fight over what they watch on TV.
Oh, my goodness.
And, in fact, I was talking to one family who, you know, again, these financial times, they had to eliminate cable. And so they used to have all these choices, and they only get one TV station now. So, or they have to put in videos, and videos can be stopped. And they saw this huge change in the atmosphere of their family. So I think most people, you know, there are people whose kids kind of, I had one mom come up to me and say, "You know, we should have free events for parents because I need a cup of coffee. They should offer a free cup of coffee somewhere." My four-year-old, you know. So sometimes it's hard for people. But most people I talk to go, "Gosh, we should do this all year." And yet, you know, then it, homework. That's another really, I had one family tell me that they used to fight with their children to do their homework, right? And as soon as the TV went off, it was like amazing. They weren't fighting with their kid to get up in the morning because they hadn't been staying up so late. homework was done. You know, it wasn't this enticement. So, you know, people discover interesting things about their families and themselves. And the hope is, and some of the research shows that people do, in fact, set some limits when they finish TV turn off. It's like fasting, right? That they set some new kinds of limits. And people do all kinds of creative things with limits.
Fasting and detox.
And detox, in a certain way, yes.
We're talking about TV Turnoff Week. Shelley Manlev is with the Santa Fe Public Schools Office of Student Wellness. Her daughter, Eliana Ward, Lev, joining us for the, fifth year in a row, I think, is a sixth grader at the Santa Fe Girls School. Thank you both so much for being with us, and help us celebrate TV Turnoff Week from now until next Sunday.
Have a great time. Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Great to see you, Eliana.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking about complexity science. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Stephen Guerin. He is a principal with Redfish Group and chair of Santa Fe Complex. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you're going to be speaking tonight from 6 to 8 with the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers in a talk titled Using Computer Games to Stimulate Complex Real-World Problems. That's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe. And it's sort of a little ironic that we're talking about video games after TV Turnoff Week, which includes video screens. Video games and real-world problems seems like almost a contradiction.
Well, real-world problems are very complex these days, where there's a lot of interactions. Computer games are a place where many things can happen at once, and kids are growing up with these tools and have an understanding of how to interact with a computer. So we're using computer games and the kind of technology behind it to simulate very large, complex systems. So computer games and the industry have generated a lot of technology in the computer, like your graphics card that makes it very fast, allows some of those what are called game engines to run very fast, and they compete with tools that are coming out of the labs. So the industry of computer games is a great place to look for new developments in technology that can help us solve problems.
So first of all, let's talk about what complexity science is. In other words, when we're talking about complex systems, what are they, and how do they differ from simple systems?
Right. So the complex systems may sound like an imposing thing, but they're at the foundation, they're systems with a lot of interacting components. It's kind of a homegrown science in Santa Fe, so internationally. People look to Santa Fe as one of the places in the world that this kind of thinking has developed, coming out of Los Alamos Labs in the 80s and research at Sandia Labs. The mecca of complex systems is Santa Fe Institute up on Hyde Park Road. And so looking at a system, traditionally science and other spaces looking at systems like economics or finance or just social systems tend to break down a system into isolated parts. Complexity is about how do we reintegrate and synthesize a system and look at the interactions and how they can generate order.
So I was talking to one of your colleagues at Santa Fe Complex the other day, and he was saying that when you have a complex system like a flock of birds, there's actually some very simple rules that govern the flight of a flock of birds and why they flock the way they do, and using very simple algorithm, you can make a graphic of that on a computer.
Right. This is something that was researched in the late 80s by Craig Reynolds. He was a Hollywood animator looking at Batman's Returns, and he had the task of, how am I going to handle all these bats in the movie coming out of a cave? And the traditional approach would be like a puppeteer having to tell every bat where to go. And at the macro level, or the higher level, a flock of birds or a school of fish is a very complex system. The dynamics are twisting and turning and very hard to capture with a couple of equations. But if you approach the problem from the bottom and just look at the bats or the fish or the birds in that system and look at their interactions, we don't really care too much what's going on inside their minds, but how do they interact? Some will try to make sure they don't collide, they'll align themselves, and they'll move to the center of mass of each other. Those three simple rules can drive the dynamics of flock. Once you put 5,000 of those in the computer and watch the system run.
And amazingly, it'll look like a flock of bats or birds.
Yes, with very similar dynamics.
And so when you talk about using computer games to simulate real-world problems, and I actually find it fascinating, a little scary that such a breakthrough came through a Batman animation. But never mind. What kind of real problems are you looking at solving? Are you working on?
So we've done some local projects. For instance, we worked with some students maybe 5 years ago when Chief Lennon was here, looking at the crowd dynamics at Zizobra and Chief Sperling.
So do people in crowds behave like bats?
To some degree, the interactions are very similar. People try to minimize the collisions with each other. When you're going out towards the exit, you align with each other. The advantage of this kind of simulation is you can also have many kinds of agents, maybe a parent with a child, and they're constrained by, if their child kind of falls behind, they'll go back with them. So we're able to simulate maybe 20 to 30,000 people leaving Zizobra. That was a local project, but
so you made a video game simulation that was actually a graphic that looked like and simulated the traffic flow of people leaving Zizobra.
That's right.
And so how did that help the police department or the traffic control people or whatever?
Yeah. So this is the crowds leaving Zizobra. So this is when there's a lot of people managing the event. For instance, the Kiwanis and the police and the fire. Departments all have their own concerns, so this was a chance to look at the park and say, well, what if we made sure that everyone came in for multiple exits? Because in times of stress, people tend to go where they tend to leave where they came in from. So it was very important to have multiple ticket booths entering the park as well as leaving, letting more people know where the exits are. That was an example.
And so, it did help. It did make a difference.
Right. Right.
Very interesting. And are these things still used in the city for such things?
Maybe 2 years later, we looked at wildfire evacuation. So this was the interaction of two complex systems, looking at the traffic flow through town, coupled with the dynamics of a wildfire. And we looked at five scenarios around town of if a cigarette butt hit I-25, someone threw it out their window, and the wind was coming out of the southwest, what would the fire look like, first of all? What would the smoke and flame length look like, and how long would it take to reach the mountains? And then what would the traffic look like in response to that? And teaching people that maybe shelter in place is a good option if there's not time to evacuate.
So there's also a study that you're doing about Venice, Italy.
Right. So this is kind of more, again, to the, this is the international community is looking to Santa Fe is coming up, and New Mexico in general is a place where this kind of thinking is the mecca. So it's this is looking at how is the traffic, which in Venice is all boats pretty much. There's a couple cars on the west side near the train station, but pretty much all the restaurant, the trash pickup, the ambulances, is all boats. So we're simulating the traffic on the canals with what's called agent-based modeling is the term of this kind of simulation, looking at how different stakeholders in Venice can manage the canals. The city wants to minimize the waves and the noise. The taxi drivers want to minimize the length of their routes. The cargo drivers want to maximize how much cargo they can deliver. All of these three factions need to kind of get around a common table and look at the problem as a group. And so simulation and visualization of the canals in Venice is one of those approaches.
So tell us more about Santa Fe Complex.
So Santa Fe Complex is something that's opening in 2 weeks, May 1st. It's in the northwest corner of the rail yard along Agua Fria at 624 Agua Fria. It's a place where we see there's a real need for people doing project work in Santa Fe. If there's a loose term of the Santa Fe approach in complex systems, extending beyond the scientific and theoretical research, but many practitioners in Santa Fe, whether they consider themselves complexity researchers, many have kind of a very similar perspective of how systems can emerge from the interactions of local individuals and the importance of looking at the whole system when addressing a problem and not little components. So we see the Santa Fe Complex as a place where many different pockets of Santa Fe researchers and thinkers can come together and work on projects. Internships and mentorships with students is a key mission, so kids can get real-world experience working on these problems. In a tongue-in-cheek way, we call it Warehouse 42, or 63 or 84, depending on who we're talking to. But it's a place where people can come together and create new ways of looking at systems, visualization, simulation, game design, And so, again, opening May 1st.
And so I was actually over there the other day taking a look at it and trying to grasp what's going on there. And it's hard to understand. Do you expect is part of it people actually showing up and coming together in the building, or is a lot of this expected to be done in a cyber kind of way?
I think a combination of both, but we see the importance of place and the importance of, first of all, Santa Fe and northern New Mexico as a place internationally where people are coming together, and the Santa Fe complex in particular where people are able to work on their own projects, but also be informed by what other people are researching and doing. So one of the metaphors is the Renaissance Bottega, where artists used to work together in a common space and be informed by each other's research. Someone over in the corner might be researching the latest techniques in mixing pigments. The master artists were you know, using these techniques in their work and training students on how this is done. So much work in Santa Fe is done on a project basis versus company basis. People come and go on projects, and we think it's important to have a place where students can come and get kind of infused into the project kind of work going on in Santa Fe, and seeing there's much more potential in Santa Fe for creative outlets and work beyond thinking about, well, where can I go get a job? But, you know, these are paying projects that kids could work on, so we're excited about the Santa Fe complex as being that kind of nexus.
So how do you get young people involved? I mean, I imagine there's a barrier you have to break through when you start talking about, complexity math.
Right. I think it's actually a very natural transition, and there's a couple organizations in New Mexico that we're working with, and they're just doing fantastic work. The Supercomputing Challenge is one of them. It's kind of a science fair for computing, where kids get to work on these complex systems. Today they're on their way up to Los Alamos for kind of the final judging and presentations of their work. 300 students from around the state are looking at things like crowd dynamics or wildfire evacuation or the spread of epidemics. So that's a fantastic group that we work with. That group, another one out of Santa Fe Institute, is Project Guts, which is growing up thinking scientifically, is another way where kids get to interact with and look at complex systems with computer games and actually physical exercises. And we think it's not a very even though the word is intimidating, actually. It's a very natural way of looking at systems. So as I was mentioning before, the flock of birds, if you tried to represent that with mathematical equations, it would be very difficult and complicated, and it would take, up through graduate school before you can kind of really get the right kind of equations to capture it. But with agent-based modeling or this game design kind of approach, it's a very easy and natural way to represent systems.
We're talking to Stephen Guerin about complexity science, and he will be tonight at the Santa Fe Cafe for Young Thinkers in a lecture titled Using Computer Games to Simulate Complex Real-World Problems. That's from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex. And so if young people are there, are you going to give them ways to actually get involved once the tonight's event is over?
Right, yeah. So there's many internships, mentorships, and opportunities, and we'll be basically recruiting people to work on projects in the community, looking at issues facing our community and how we can represent them with visualization and games.
Is there a number or website that people can go to if they're not able to show up tonight?
I think the Google keywords for Bob Eisenstein's Science Cafe would be Science Cafe Santa Fe, and that'll come up right away. Santa Fe Complex, it is sfcomplex.org, and I'm at redfish.com.
Stephen Guerin, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Right, thank you. This is an institution. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Todd Lester and Stefan Barbic from Free Dimensional. We're going to find out what that is in just a moment. And Diane Karp, who is the director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And so Todd Lester is going to be giving a workshop on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. But first of all, tell us about your work with Free Dimensional. What is this organization?
Thank you. Well, Free Dimensional is a network of community art spaces around the world. We're 50 strong in about 40 countries. The raison d'etre for creating Free Dimensional about 3 years ago was that myself and my colleagues, we saw a dilemma in the human rights world. We saw that human rights defenders or culture workers in exile didn't have a place to live when they would leave their home countries. and that in the arts world that there was actually a capacity, if you looked across the 2,000 or so existing residential artist communities, that they must all have surplus space. So we attempted to forge those two corners of civil society together to one feed off the other's capacity.
So what was the first project that you did? Where did you place people from another country? What was the story?
Well, that's a really interesting story because I just got an email forward the other day that a cartoonist from Cameroon, Issa Nyafaga, will be coming to be in residence at Santa Fe in a few months. He was our first, actually. He's a cartoonist from Cameroon. He's a journalist and a visual artist. After 11 imprisonments, he escaped Cameroon to France.
Now he was doing political cartoons.
Political cartoons. He was working for a local daily newspaper in Douala, the largest and port city in Cameroon, and just started to receive sort of a backlash against his work, even though he was using a assumed name, you know, his sort of cartoon name. People were starting to figure out who he was and calling him in the streets by that name. And so police and other officials were starting to associate this as who's making fun of us in the daily paper. He was imprisoned on 11 occasions, on several of those tortured to various degrees, and ultimately made the decision that he had to leave the country. And he this August, he will go back for the second time. He went back once to visit his mother surreptitiously, and this time probably will also be very cautious. Cameroon has a really difficult political landscape right now with the president trying to extend the constitution to stay on another term. We run a residency in New York City where our home office is. It's called the Center for International Art and Community. We work strategically with an art hotel that gives us free space for artists to lodge. And about 2 years ago, we asked the hotel if they would be willing to accommodate Issa for 3 months during our first residency. So he was the first case.
How did you find out about him in the first place?
We work with a group of about 25 nominating organizations. Those organizations range from the big ones that you probably have heard of, PEN, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, to very small ones in local areas, such as the Anti-Trafficking Center in Belgrade, Serbia, some small organizations in Kabul, Afghanistan. So we have this network of nominators, and the nominations come to us sometimes just people we know, sometimes they come through organizational letters of nomination, and it was one of those situations. A person who knew him and knew us nominated him.
So I would imagine these things come very much through the network of personal relationships, and because one doesn't read. I mean, there was that very famous case about the Muhammad cartoon, but you don't hear about political cartoonists in other countries most of the time.
That's a pretty interesting point because actually, you know, in the way that advocacy for free expression and human rights has historically worked, you either fit in a category or you don't. So if you're a literary figure, and I'll use, you know, the big name of Salman Rushdie, who we all know that he went into exile very publicly, you know, there's a lot of support for a writer, either through academia or journalism. When it comes to something like a visual artist who has one foot in journalism, one foot in the visual arts, there aren't a lot of organizations that have support for that individual in their mandate. So you're right in saying that about cartoonists, but at the same time, there have been several political cartoonists who've been assassinated, whose cases we know about, and many more who are harassed on a daily basis.
And because it's such an effective and visible medium, it reaches way more people than
Absolutely.
Any art gallery show.
And also for literacy purposes, you know, these are countries where, you know, people, you know, I can think of Cameroon because I've lived there for several years, where, you know, the newspapers hang on a stall and you might not even buy it, but you might walk up and look at the cartoons or look at the headlines and then walk on without reading the articles.
We're talking to Todd Lester of Free Dimensional. Now, you are going to be teaching or giving a workshop at the Santa Fe Institute this week. Tell us about it. What are people going to do?
Well, if you'll allow me to switch gears a little bit, yeah. The Creative Safe Haven service that I've just described is what we've done for the last 3 years. And through that service, we've accommodated 30 individuals. We're in a process as an organization of starting our newest program area, and that is we support the community outreach of all of our member centers, and specifically ones who are picking up critical issues in their neighborhoods, their surroundings. So, for example, currently we've started up a small office in Cairo where we're working with the Townhouse Gallery to engage refugee populations. Cairo is a city with 1 million refugees, so there's always work and things to do, art being used as a tool to affect change, to start dialogues, to mitigate tensions. But specific to the work we'll be doing for the next 4 days here in Santa Fe, we're supporting our partner center in Dakar, Senegal. It's called the Atelier Mustapha Dime. It's a small artist colony on an island just off the capital city called Gori Island. And Gabby Kimsu, the director there, has been working for a long time on the issues of economic migration coming from Senegal and more broadly West Africa out to the world. For the last 10 years, that's been primarily to Europe via the Canary Islands. But we know now that more of these boats are landing in the Caribbean or landing on the coast of the U.S. So we're helping Gabby during the time of the Dakar Biennale, which is May 9th through June 9th, to conduct a campaign that sensitizes the mainstream public, the media locally, and especially the international media who will be attending the Dakar Biennale. So we're using the fact very tactically that media will come to an art event to hook them on a bigger social issue. And it's also very specifically nuanced because the art world has picked up on issues of economic migration for several of the last years. So if you had attended the Venice Biennale or Documenta in Germany, you would see these visuals of economic migration. And what we think as an organization is it's incumbent upon us to do some literacy and awareness work in Dakar because it's proximate to the flight. And it's also during one of these art world events. About a year ago, 14 Senegalese men arrived to the coast of the U.S. After a 50-day boat trip, they arrived on the 31st of January 2007. They arrived during a winter period.
They crossed the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. They crossed the Atlantic.
A catamaran.
A catamaran?
Right.
Good heavens. And then what happened?
Well, Stefan, jump in anytime you want. I'll tell a little bit more of the story. They were all summarily detained, is what happened. 10 of them were summarily deported. And Free Dimensional, we have organizationally, so our staffers, basically friends of the organization, have visited the remaining four over the last few months. Now, what's happened in the last few months is two more have been deported. One has received political asylum, and there remains one of these detainees in prison in New Jersey. Now, in the broader world of forced migration, what he is in is a warehouse. So he's, it's both physically a warehouse and conceptually what is called warehousing. So when economic migrants come to a country, they're just stockpiled, which is a really inhumane way of thinking about it. But this has started happening in wholesale fashion in the Canary Islands, which used to be a primary transit route. It's happening in a lot of the northern African countries. The storage of people being outsourced by the European Union, and of course it's happening in the U.S. with this case, but with many others and other situations that we probably all know about.
Or don't know about. Well, it's one of the things that I think is really important to talk about is that in a country where we supposedly have the right to a fair and speedy trial, there are exceptions to this where people are put away. They don't even have access to their families or lawyers if they're in an immigration detention.
Exactly.
And for any amount of time, there's no limit to the amount of time they can be detained.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that we feel strongly about working on this, but certainly don't take an ideological stance or a political stance, our point of view is not don't do this or do this. The very specific vehicle of activism that we're taking back to Dakar is a pamphlet. Both the Spanish and the Swiss governments have issued propaganda campaigns in Senegal to dissuade folks from taking these boat trips to Europe. The Swiss was a TV commercial, and the Spanish was a pamphlet campaign itself. We're going to mimic that campaign, but by providing a more robust set of information.
Well, what did those two campaigns, what was their message?
Their message was don't come. Don't come. There's not enough work. You will, there's the possibility of detention. Don't come. But at the same time, what we understand is that these young men, mostly young men, who are taking these trips have already commodified their lives in a sense. They see that there's no work for them. I'll jump to the discussions that we've had with some of the detainees in New Jersey, the 14 that I mentioned. These are guys that know very well the complexities of their government selling wholesale the fishing stores to Asian countries and those fish being removed, not fished, but removed for refishing in Asian waters. These are guys, two of which grew up in a fishing village together and learned from, the point of being able to function with their fathers on the boats, how to be boatmen. And so that they made a 50-day, pretty amazing voyage was something that they started learning how to do when they were learning a livelihood.
Right.
And then they just switched gears to use it for this migration that we're talking
that's
about.
That's an undertold story. The actual removal of and relocation of fish.
This is one of the subject, the sort of the headings in this pamphlet that we're going to distribute. And I should say that our tactic for the distribution of the pamphlet will be in three languages. It'll be in English, French, and Wolof, the primary Senegalese language. And so we see the pamphlet itself as an information campaign geared towards the public locally, whereas we see the broader media action, our online campaign that we'll be running simultaneously, being here in Santa Fe. Two nights ago, we had an event during the mayor of New York's Immigrant Heritage Week. The whole campaign is meant to garner attention from the international media, whereas at the same time, we'd like to share some information with the local public at the same time.
So what is your message to the people in Senegal that you're that's on the pamphlet that you're distributing?
It's very diverse. For example, my message is, please talk to this woman. There's a woman in Senegal who started an organization because her son drowned at sea, and she has a local advocacy organization. So first, directing them to local resources. There are other, RADO is a well-known human rights organization based for West Africa based in Senegal. So there are local resources that we would never be able to duplicate, but we can simply guide people to offices that have information. At the same time, I would also tell them that there are mafia elements that make boats, and that all the boats that are hired for these trips, there are about 40,000 people that leave the West and North African boat routes a year for these trips. So, you know, some boats are made by ex-fishermen and, you know, folks who know how to do this, and other boats are made by folks who are economizing and making money off this traffic. And I would say, you know if you're going to do this, that there are these dangers. I would also say that many countries now warehouse, that you run the risk upon arrival to not receive a warm welcome, to be put in prison, to be sent back summarily. There's some nuances here that I myself don't, you know, we're an advocacy organization. We're not a legal clinic as such. And so some of the issues that have been dealt with the 14 is that one of them actually received political asylum. There are a variety of reasons why that individual may have received political asylum, but we understand that there's a mashup here, that in general you don't think of economic migrants being political refugees, whereas in some cases they will be. And that as we further understand the push and pull factors with the world economy ending livelihoods, we might understand that many more economic migrants should or could become political refugees. So we won't pretend to know the individual cases of the 40,000 that attempt this on a yearly basis. What we do know is that about 40% of them drown at sea a year, and that's something that the broader media
campaign. That's a lot of people.
18 or so thousand, I guess. And that's what the broader media campaign seeks to effect change on, that as journalists pick it up as an issue, the only way that there'll be a trickle-down, say, policy change that, you know, that could affect this number, could diminish the number of dying at sea, is that the public know that that's happening. I think essentially it's a new disappeared group that, as long as we don't know about them, we won't care about them. And so knowing will be the first step of advocacy that Free Dimensional seeks to take.
And this is part of Santa Fe Art Institute's 2008 theme, Outsider, Tourism, Migration, and Exile. So you chose this quite consciously, Diane Karp.
Absolutely. One of the things that invariably happens is that if you're not Salman Rushdie and you're a creative person, it is the nature of the arts that they end up becoming the voice of conscience for societies, whether they're in distress or whether they're thriving. These are the people who take note of and seem to care deeply about the underprivileged, the marginalized, the disenfranchised within their communities, and when they begin to incorporate these issues in their art, they make them very public. One of the things that we know full well is that the arts, all of the arts, have the ability to touch very quickly any viewer or reader's intellect and emotions, and it's a powerful, powerful vehicle, and governments are aware of that. And so a good cartoonist, an important artist, a great writer, a journalist become easy marks. You take them away, you take away the community's voice. And people are frightened. They think they need to censor themselves at that point. So it's a very powerful system. If, on the other hand, we support those voices, what we say to the larger community is, you need to empower your voice. You need to be heard, and we can help. And you know, our motivating force for creating the residency was to do something that needed to be done to support artists in distress. And our relationship and our partnership with Free Dimensional has really been an important expansion.
Well, you've been doing all this all along with people from 9/11 and people from Hurricane Katrina.
But we have to work together, and we've not had as consistent a reach into non-dominant cultures. And the dominant cultures obviously have their own issues, but in areas like Africa, South America, Asia, the Near East, the Far East, we are in need of having people on the ground that can help us to identify those people, and that's where our partnership with Free Dimensional becomes so critical. So tonight, Todd and Stefan are going to talk about their work.
At 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall.
At 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall.
Which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, they invite anyone who's interested in engaging in the practice of finding ways to think about countering these governmental forces or engage in a particular project are welcome. So we need graphic designers, we need smart thinkers, we need writers, we need creators of all sorts. Whether you're actually an artist or a writer is not really the point. If you would like to put your time and energy and brains and heart into this, we'd love to have you as part of it.
So it's really getting people, it's not just like learning a new technique for making, you know, whatever, sculptures. You're actually getting people involved in this whole this whole issue of
well, we'll be going to Dakar in 2 weeks.
So what are you going to do when you're there?
Well, one of the things that we're going to be doing is distributing the pamphlet.
Okay.
Right. That's going to be our main action on the ground. But also, we're going to have a press conference. And not only are we trying to get the attention of the international press, but also artists who are going to be there during the Biennale.
I mean, it's interesting because when you were talking about the pamphlets from Spain and Switzerland saying, don't come. And then your pamphlet is essentially saying, don't go. You know, the alternatives, what are the alternatives for people who are deep out of work?
Yeah, I wouldn't pretend to know. I really wouldn't. I don't feel like our pamphlet will say strongly don't go. I feel like it will say know the situation, because what I remark every time I, you know, discuss this subject is that one of the gentlemen that made the trip is 24 years old, and he let me know about the selling of the fishing. You know, he let me know about these critical cumulative issues that mean that he won't be a fisherman. And so I think that it'll be a deep learning process, like a dialogue process, because we have picked the first week of the Biennale. Having been organizationally before, we know that that's when a lot of the international media will be there, so that we have this window of opportunity to shift their storylines from the art press to the mainstream. You know, some of them will be there looking for an art story. We might pull them into a social interest story. Again, the art world has really, as sexy issues come and go, has picked up on economic migration for the last couple of years and really let it cycle around in a microcosm, this bubble of the art world. We think that the time we're there might bust that bubble, and we hope that it does. Because to add to what Diane said, there are these artists that become critical voices, but also the art spaces, that this space on Glory Island said, let's do something on this. We want to help them.
Todd Lester and Stefan Barbic are with the group Free Dimensional, which can be found on the web at freedimensional.net, and Diane Karp is the director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Once again, tonight, lecture at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, workshop. For more information, 424-5050, or go to Santa Fe Art Institute at sfai.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will see you tomorrow. Be happy. Hasta la vista, baby. Thank you.